Thank you. It's a good thing they have small meetings down here, huh? My name's Joe. Joe B. I'm an alcoholic from St. Louis, Missouri. And it's good to hear that today. At one time, you terrified me when you said that. Absolutely terrified me. I remember being at a conference and a guy was looking out in the crowd. And you know how you're sitting there. I don't know how many new ones we have around. I heard we've got a pretty good amount. And that excites me. But he looked out in the crowd and he goes, "Did anybody tell you they love you today?" And I felt like he said it to me. And there was probably 800, 900, maybe 1,000 people at that conference. But I felt like that man said it directly to me. And I hope sometime tonight was something I got possibly can say, that you're going to feel that I do love you. And I'll get a chance to explain why. Last year, I was asked to come down to Baton Rouge, and I met Britt for the first time. And we got to be very good friends. The amazing thing is, when I was down there, I also found out that I think it's called boudin real well. It's some of their hottest sausage ever made to me. And I'm sitting there at the restaurant, and they brought it over to us at the table, and my buddy that's come down with me, Carrie, we're sitting there eating it, and they're dipping that stuff in that sauce and just jobbing it all over their face and just going nuts. I thought, cool. So I grabbed a big bite. Boy, here it come. I started lighting up, and I'm sweating right now, and it's not from that. I was just thinking about it. I had sweat coming off of my ears, and I'm wiping them, and the guy over there with that Cajun accent, I won't get it just right, but he goes, "Oh, I do believe you're hot there, son." Hot's an understatement. I was like, "Give the boy milk. Give the boy milk." Anyway, Carrie got to find out, you know, my buddy, you'll see him running around here over the weekend, and he got to find out, well, man down, so he ate it. He loves the stuff. Anytime I get a chance to ask, I'm not asked a whole lot, and that's good in some ways, because I like smaller scale. I like getting my sleeves up and getting them on that one-on-one or two-on-one. And messing with them. I was at a conference and we come through and this guy, I was just from across the river, is in St. Louis, and they had speakers from all over. And this little new guy come up and he's going, I'm 2 weeks in here. And I go, that's awesome. He goes, well, did you have a good trip? And it's because they had the speaker thing like this. And I said, yeah. And he says, that's good. I said, I drove. And he looked at me, because, I mean, obviously he didn't see on the flyer. I was just from across the river. He looked at me. He goes, oh, man, any links? So, and that's the joy. You know, my sponsors, I've had a certain number of them over the course of this adventure, and The one thing that they taught me in particular is we're not a glum lot. It says it in the book. And it also says we're happy, joyous, and free. But there's a certain price that has to be paid to get that happy, joyous, and free. And I had to learn that price from you all. I didn't realize when you hear people say, oh, stick around. And I love it when they said, expect the miracle. You know, there's a light at the end of that tunnel. And for myself and others, you know, this is incredible for me. And for others in here this weekend, you're going to find out it's a locomotive. It's going to hit you, and it's going to hit you hard, and that's good. I hope it hits you to the point that you want to stay a day at a time and not leave us. When I was 6 years old, my mom, I'll tell you a little bit about her so you understand the family I come from. Mom's a little, she's deceased now, but she's a little 225-pound Cherokee Indian lady, and I think she said she had some Irish and Scotch and other stuff. She wasn't sure, but she believed Indian stuff, and she was about 5'1", and she wore this Hawaiian muumuu with sandals, and she'd keep her hair in rollers for the, you know, when the event needed to, they needed to come out. She kept ready. And I had come home from Vietnam, and I decided I'm going to be a hippie. So when you're a hippie, at least how I learned it, you don't use doors. You use beads. So I put these beads up on my door, and my dad says, "Son, you need to put a door on that." I said, "Dad, I'm a hippie." And he says, "I don't care what you are, you need a door on there." I said, "Hippies don't use doors, please." And he goes, "All right." And my brother goes, "What are you doing? You need a door." And, "Nope, not me." So I've got my beads up, and I got my little stuff all around in the house. And Mom, she found this in my luggage that got sent back. It was a little, what they call a water bowl. Some of you may know what that is. And it was real ornate, beautiful. And Mom's, you know, she's not real fast to the draw on this stuff. And she goes, "Joe, where'd you get that? That come from Vietnam." I said, "Yeah." She goes, "I'm going to put that in my china closet." And up there it goes. And I'm going, and Dad's looking at her going, "Might as well let go of that one." And she had the only key. So I'm got to go get another bowl. That one's done. But the thing that was great is people had come over that had an idea, and Mom would go, "Look what Joe brought from Vietnam." And Dad's going, "Oh, yeah, more than that, too." So anyway, the reason I describe Mom to you is she worked hard her whole life. Hard. She was a waitress and a barmaid, and she did whatever she had to do to get us kids up and raised. And I'm over entertaining one of my hippie girlfriends one evening down in the room with the beads. And Mom come down to ask me something, and I was busy entertaining, and I heard, and I knew we got to get dressed, and we got to get dressed right now. And she's going, "This is your room. Stand up to her. Be a man." I said, "No, you don't understand my mom. We need to go now." And I could hear her in the pots and pans. I said, "This is not good, Cindy. We got to go." And my sister was home, and she's up there. And the way she describes it, she tells the story better than I do. She said, "Mom looked like Linda Blair on The Exorcist when she's up there in the pots and pans." And Rosie goes, "What's up, Mom?" And she, her head cranks around like that. She goes, "Do you know what he's doing down there?" And Rosie goes, "No, but I'm staying for this one." And here comes Mom. She's got this 12-inch cast iron army skillet and them flip-flops. And here she comes, and she don't care. There's no such thing as child abuse in her world when she sees her hippie son entertaining in her home. And here she comes, and I'm standing in front of Cindy, and she's holding her blouse. And I go, "You'll not hurt the woman I love." And Mom goes, boom, with that skillet right here. And as she hit me, I just started going down, and I go, "Run, Cindy." That's all I could tell her. And Mom swung and hit her and knocks her down the steps. And I'm going, "This is out of control." And Cindy runs out the door. Mom's behind her, calling her some few names. And she's got that skillet in the air, and the little flip-flops are bup-bup-bup-bup-bup. And Cindy's running, holding her blouse, going, "Don't hit me again, Mrs. Barclay, don't hit me." And she's saying something else to her, and I'm in behind her holding my head going, "Please." You know, my hippie career was short-lived. They have a way of giving you something that's going to last your whole life. Your whole life. And what a lady she was. And when she got ready to go to the other side, the only way I knew it is as Dad was driving to take her to the hospital, she said, "Goodbye, son." And she had never said that before. And I knew we were closing that chapter. I didn't know how to handle death real well until I found you all. I learned since coming into Alcoholics Anonymous that you all are giant killers. No matter how big something is, just for today, you can show me, if I stay with you, you can show me how to take it down. Because stuff, I don't know about you, but stuff gets huge. And sometimes speakers, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, man, I got to get dressed. And me and Shelby were laughing at dinner. And it's like, you know, man, I got to get a tie and all that. And, you know, get fixed up. And I'm sitting here going, God, I do not need to get a pimple on my nose. And when I seen this red mic, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, there that baby is, right there. As soon as I asked for it, not to happen. Here you go, Joe. And you know what? Today it's okay. I'm here as a result of some stuff that's happened to a dear member in this fellowship. I'm trying to fill in. I hope I can come just somewhat close. And I want you to keep Sandy in your prayers, if you would, through the weekend. Huge thing that's going on there. I want to thank the committee for bringing me here. And no, I've still got some more talk. Don't. It's like, oh, he's thanking us now. It's over. I want to thank them because they went on somebody's recommendation for me. And that's huge. That's a legacy that you get a chance to present and others believe in you even when you don't believe in yourself. And they went on that recommendation and they spent a lot of money to get me here. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate the gift I found in my room when I got up there to change. You know, and the care and the love that I felt since, you know, we got on the plane this morning to come here. You're a tremendous group of people, and I applaud you. You know, you give yourself a lot of credit for what you're doing for us. When I was 6 years old, Mom had us in a Catholic school. I was down in the cafeteria, and a big kid come up. And you learn right away, big kid, you got to share. And I had a bacon sandwich, and that was a big deal to us because we come up. I grew up in East St. Louis. It's the other side of St. Louis across the Mississippi River in Illinois, next to that state of Chicago. And we're down in this school, and this kid come up, and he says, what are you eating? And I told him. And he used the N-word, and he knocked it out of my hand. And I don't know if everybody was looking or not. All I know is everything got quiet to me, and it got like I was in a tunnel. And I started crying. And then when I was little, and if I cried in front of you, you know, that was big. Because I wasn't brought up, you know, show your feelings. You stuff them. People are going to call you names. You're too big. You're too fat. You're too skinny. Why are you so tall? Why are you so short? And just bombarding. And what I learned to do from early on is to detach from you. And that's not a real healthy thing to do. I do not encourage anyone in this room to do that. I started detaching from people. I could be standing right there with you, looking right at you, and I was not there. So when I had my first drink at 13, all of a sudden, I'm back. The magic happened. I fell in love. I didn't care what you thought about me. I didn't care how I looked. It was a good day to be alive. But alcohol was not going to be that kind to me. I wouldn't get a chance to go into full experience of alcohol till years later. I entered into the armed services. And by the way, just a show of hands, any veterans, male or female, we have in the crowd. Oh, just thank you. Thank you for your service. And is there any fellow Vietnam veterans other than myself? Oh, thank you. Welcome home. Welcome home. Thank you. I got a chance to ask that at a conference years ago, and a little guy come up just shaking and eyes watered up and hugged me and almost popped. And he says, I know that I heard it. I finally heard it. I mean, people probably told him before, but he finally heard it. And I hope you hear that tonight. But anyway, I go into the armed services. I'm 17. My parents have to sign me in because I'm not old enough to do it. Mom's against it. Dad's saying, we can't do a whole lot with him. Let's see if they can. So they sign the papers. Well, while you're in there, they give you a piece of paper, at least they used to, and it said on there, where do you want to go? And I'm going to be really, really good about this. I'm going to Vietnam. It's 1970. I'm going. And I put down for all three of my choices, Vietnam. And I'm looking at everybody else, and they're putting down goofy stuff like Hawaii, England, Italy, Germany. They're not going to get to go there. But they let me go where I went. And I got orders. I got on the plane. We left Yokota, Japan for our last leg of the flight down to Benoit, South Vietnam. And as we was coming in, they announced our approach, and I noticed out off our wings there's two F-4 Phantoms, one on each side. And a little alert, little light started going off real quick for me. And I asked the sergeant next to me, I said, hey, what's with this? He said, I just keep us from getting shot down. He was on his second time coming back. And I was 17 years old. I hadn't turned 18 yet. But I realized I was smart enough, I'd done something real stupid. The plane landed. You can see a veil of heat at the door, and they can attest to that. It's a veil of heat, and you'd have no idea what heat is till you hit that. And I backed up into the plane, and I don't care how it's looking. I looked at the stewardess. I said, I'm not getting out here. And she says, honey, you have to. We're going to take guys that's already been here their time. We're going to take them home. I said, I won't be any problem. I was like, this is blowing me away. And anyway, I had to leave the plane. And the Army was real gracious. They issued me a wool blanket. And I didn't realize that one of the miracles that I got a chance to see after I got with this fellowship, one of the miracles occurred there. And that miracle was, I was a combat engineer, and I was assigned to a gun truck unit. And we got there, and we're in a line, and the first sergeant's making the assignments. And I was the next man he was going to talk to. And the orderly come out and said something to him. He says, okay, I'll get you somebody. He steps in front of me, and he goes, we just got a request. We've got a freshwater lake close to here, and they need a lifeguard. Can you believe that? I'm standing there looking at them, terrified, and I'm looking over at those trucks, and Mako couldn't help them. They were some mad people about them trucks. There was bullet holes and wings and dings and everything in them, and I'm looking at them trucks, and I'm looking at him and going, I don't believe what I'm hearing, but I was nodding my head yes. And to tell you the fast part of it is I hit that water like Flipper. I took the test, I passed it, and I was a lifeguard for the time I was there. I seen guard duty, but as far as out sloshing through the swamps and the paddies and getting dropped into elephant grass, you know, I was spared all that. I also was not spared survivor guilt, however, because I accepted that job and my buddies didn't get it. They didn't get that job. And so I've had to learn to process that, and it's ongoing, that I was selected for that job, and any one of them could have qualified for it. But God, as I understand Him in His graciousness, allowed me to have that job. And I love the word grace. Grace means unmerited favor. I did absolutely nothing to get that given to me. I did absolutely nothing to get this program placed in my life. I was doing a lot of other stuff to judges and police officers and stuff, but I did nothing to get here. That was going to be another miracle. While I was in that country, the Vietnamese knew I was real young, so they wouldn't sell me anything, because whiskey was $1.85 a fifth. A pound of marijuana pot was $10. And I had to go a long time on learning not to tell kids of, well, there's 16 ounces or 16 lids in a pound. And, you know, it's like, whoa, whoa, time out. You're not a hippie no more. And while I was there, I was going to experience all that, especially the alcohol. It was so cheap, so available. But the other thing I did in my astonishing career of showing people how nuts I could be, is a buddy received a little envelope from California, where there's a lot of hippies. And he goes, oh, it arrived. I said, what did? And he says, well, you know. And he showed me. I go, oh, sure. I didn't have an idea what he's showing me. It was a little stamp looking thing. And I go, that's cool. He says, well, you know, it's really the stuff. And I go, well, yeah. And I'm trying to, you know, what do you do with the stuff? But I didn't want to ask him. So I ate it. And he's looking at me going, no. And I go, what? And he goes, I got to get some help. I said, help for what? And I'm starting to lose it. And he's going, I don't know where you're going. I said, I'm right here. He says, no, I don't know where you're going. You just ate a lot of acid. I don't know where you're going. And so he takes off. And I'm sitting there, and I happen to be on guard that day, and the water's there. And my buddy's gone. And I'm looking around, and water's glistening. I said, looks pretty nice. So I went and got in. And while I was down there, I thought, this is why fish like this. This is all right. And they come in and got me. They got back. When I come home, and me and Doug were talking about this today, there's sometimes that you look the part of what you are so much, and you don't think you do. And I come home, and I've got these little round beetle sunglasses on, and my hair, my daughter says, Daddy, it was Nemo orange. It was blonde, please. It was blonde hair, blonde mustache, these little dark beetle sunglasses, and I'm getting down off the plane, and I'm bebopping down the concourse, and the custom agents, they go, oh, you, sir, right here. Everybody's looking, they say, no, you, and they point to me, and my buddies got clear of me. And this part of my story, it's going to be like Evelyn Wood speed reading. I'll just tell you, they're thorough, they search very well and very quickly, that's all. I got back to St. Louis, and my own mom did not recognize her son. I remember the look on her face when I come in. I was burnt very, very dark from the sun over there. And I remember Mom, when we was kids, saying, you know, I was the one that had to stay inside. You know, she didn't want me getting darker. And that was her own issues that she had to deal with. But she didn't want me getting darker. It just wasn't acceptable. And here I am coming in the door. And I mean, I'm like almost like this coat. And she's just like, who is that? And it dawned on me. I had changed. I changed a lot. I had found a relationship that I would seek for the next several years. And it talks about it in the book that we'll seek it to the point of insanity and possibly death. The obsession and the compulsion of alcohol. I found that I was trying more and more to control. And I was alibiing it, saying, well, I got stuff I have to do. And I remember looking at people with those eyes. And everybody in this room, even Al-Anon, Alateen, everybody in this room knows what those eyes look like. You're not spared from that. And I remember looking out of them eyes, and I was promising and just wanting with every fever of my being to believe it. That this will be the day I'm not going to do it anymore. And it's the universal lie. It tells us in here, this in the book, this is the only illness out of all of them, out of all the diseases, this is the only one that tells you there's nothing wrong. It keeps telling you that. And I'm pursuing this, and I remember sitting there, and I was a member of the VFW, and they made a big deal of me, and I'm sitting there, and in all arrogance, I'm looking at somebody passed out next to me, and her glasses over on the thing, and I looked at him, I thought, if I couldn't drink any better than that, I'd quit. I didn't say it, I just thought it. You know, sometimes some of you in here will know we think a lot of stuff and don't say it. We learn. And then all the next morning, there's a police officer with his nightstick beating me on the bottom of my boots, telling me, get up, get your pants on, and get out of here. I had went out to my truck, got there, and I don't know what it is about opening a car door when you're drunk, but that ball thing starts, and I'm like, oh. And I get my pants down, and I'm sitting there, and I'm hanging on, looking around, and I don't remember anything other than him hitting me on the boots. And I had it, I mean, I waller. I had it everywhere. And he's like, son, do something with yourself. Go. But if I couldn't drink like that person next to me, I'd quit. Do you see where the insanity is coming? And I learned very early on to try and hide it. I got what I thought was real ingenious. You know, I learned that you could leave the cap off and stick it up in the freezer and keep it from exploding and thaw it out later. I also learned that there's a turkey farm up above me, and when you're snatching turkeys and dragging them down the hillside, it leaves a trail of feathers. And I was in a blackout. I still to this day do not remember it, but the guy that owned the turkey farm, he comes down, he's on our trailer door, and I open it and I say, "What can I do for you?" He says, "Somebody stole a turkey." I said, "Really?" He says, "Yeah, and the feathers end in your yard." I said, "If I see him, I'll get him back to you." Well, in the process of that insanity, I fill this in because I've heard people say, "Well, I was in a blackout and they got really good recall." I didn't. People had to fill the blanks in for me. And the best description I've heard of a blackout is a camera without film. Stuff's being photographed, but nothing's being recorded. And there's a deputy knocking at the door. And he hands me this piece of paper. And I'm looking at it like, I need to stay away from my wife. Well, what had happened when I got all the story is I come home, and I'm ashamed to say that I struck her. I took a rifle and shot at her. She went out the door. I went outside, and I was asking her in the kindest voice I could muster, "Please come out. I just want to talk." She practiced awesome Al-Anon. She detached. She was not coming out wherever she was. I destroyed that rifle. I to this day do not know where it's at. I hooked up my boat. I don't know why drunks want to tear up their stuff. I hook up my boat. I back it into the shed that I put together with all my stuff in it, destroy it, and I come in. All her stuff's there, but here's my stereo. Boom, I'll show you. And I'm destroying my stereo, and I pass out in the glass. And this sheriff's giving me this paper, and it said on there to stay away. And I thought, man, I don't understand this. So I'm going to go to VFW, and I go down there, and I ask them. They said, "Let's see that." They said, "I don't mean nothing." I said, "Really?" It says, "I can get in trouble if I go." They said, "Man, we get them all the time." I said, "Well, cool. Let's have a drink." So it's on. The way I got here, here's the next miracle. My mother-in-law used, and I know you're going to find this hard to believe that alcoholics have an ego, but that's what she used to get me in this program. And this is God. It has to be God working. She approached me and she says, "Joe, you get along great with people. Can you come down to this facility? I'm helping them get on assistance and talk with them." And I said, "What's that?" And she goes, "It's alcoholics and drug addicts. And you talk awesome. Can you visit with them?" Here's the insanity. I look there, I go, "Sure." And I went down. And I went down and I got into place and I was staying low key, you know. And I'm looking around and not wanting to look obvious, you know. My sponsor, this deceased, he used to say a lot of times alkies can not, you know, try to hide their butt and they leave it showing. But I'm standing there and the guy comes up to me. He says, "Hi, I'm John. I'm a counselor here. Can I help you?" And I mean, that's a regular, normal introduction. Okay. I look at him. I go, "Hi, I'm Joe. I'm in college." He goes, "Oh." I said, before he could even get bounced back from it, I go, "I'm taking aviation technology and psychology," which I was. And I said, "My mother-in-law wants me to come down here and help you with these people." And he goes, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Now, I said, I'm usually in the clear on a Saturday sometimes, and I've got this already, I've got a time schedule for you." I found out later on, and I've gotten in trouble for this statement, but there's a guy at a meeting one time, and he goes, "Don't you call me after 9 o'clock at night or before 7 in the morning. And I'm sitting there, and boy, they all kind of, you know, he's an old head, and they're all kind of, ooh. And I thought, that's telling them. So I hightailed my butt down to another meeting, and I made sure nobody was there from that meeting. And I'm looking around. I go, don't you call me after 9 o'clock at night and 4-7 in the morning. And my sponsor got word of that. He called me over and he goes, get over here. And I, yeah. And he goes, did you make that statement? And I said, well, yeah. He says, you show me in this book. You show me where it says that. I said, and I broke anonymity. I said, so-and-so said it. And I give him up. I mean, phew, here you go, buddy. So the ones that's new in the program, I want you to stay with me a minute. Because the newcomer is so precious to the lifeblood of this fellowship. That word right there, if you don't come in, ceases to happen. When Bill was standing in the Mayflower Hotel, I've had the privilege to be there, and I was looking around, and the guide we had was explaining what was going on, and I was just overtaken feeling what went on. He described him standing there, not even enough money to get home. There's music coming down from a lounge, then the laughter. And isn't that what I would want to gravitate to? And there's a board that's got a series of numbers on it of a church directory. And he started calling that, realizing that maybe if I try to help another, I'll stay sober. That moment of clarity for me is one of the hugest miracles that's ever transpired that I know in mankind for a drunk. And I feel so honored to know that I was able to come in to this group of people and them accept me when I couldn't accept myself. When I went and approached John at that treatment center, I didn't realize in a week I would be a client there. In that week, everything unraveled. My wife left for what she said was forever. I found myself drunk and going to a church late at night, and I went on inside and I sat in the back row and I started laughing. It's a little uncomfortable, but if you laugh, it gets you over it. And I went on up to the front pew, and they've got this little thing up there that shows where I believe, you know, in being brought up Catholic for the moment, that God's up there. And I'm sitting there, and I thought, well, the priest handles that end of it. I don't want to get that close yet. So I'm going to sit here in this front row, and I started laughing again. And then all of a sudden it hit me. I said, God, if you exist, please help me. And I went on laughing some more. I seen a priest the next day, started talking to him. He said, son, we can put some things together to help you. I said, anything, Father. And I don't know, most people in this room knows David Copperfield, the magician. And when I'm active in my illness, I can do that. I can show you that what you seen, you did not. And what you heard, you did not. Stay around me. And I pulled him right in. But to also let something out to him, I said, you know, I really appreciate the church being here and everything for me last night. He says, son, what are you talking about? And I told him. He says, what time did you say you was there? And I told him. He says, I'm going to tell you something. Young man, I'm not doubting that you were in our church. He says, I'm a man of faith. But he says, I need to tell you that at 8 o'clock last night, me and the Monsignor and the custodian all check ourselves and lock all the doors here because of the neighborhood. I said, well, you forgot to lock that one I went through. He says, son, I just told you what we do. I still couldn't accept that when my father's ready to unlock any door, it means absolutely nothing for him to do that. It's that easy. When I come to AA, I bottomed out because alcohol failed me. I had drank so much I couldn't get drunk any longer. I don't know if anybody's experienced that. You probably have. Drank yourself sober. And the voices wouldn't shut off. And they were telling me everything that I was drinking to not hear. And they wouldn't shut off. And I remember, you know, I don't know on you, but I don't cry real good. I mean, my eyes water up. I can't see out of them. And I'm, you know, doing a big wipe and all that. And I'm sitting there like that. And it hit me, you don't have to live like this. And the thought of AA didn't come to me right then. The thought of a gun did. And I ended up putting it up to my mouth. And I was looking down and I seen all kinds of triggers. And I kept trying to punch it, the one that would do it. And I obviously missed it. And I was getting more frustrated by the moment. Please, please God, let these voices shut off. I can't take this. And I'm pushing and pushing. And I just remember passing out. The next morning I had a little thing. I was like, I'm up and I'm shaking and I go, I cannot, I knew it's like, I just tried to take my life. And I didn't realize it till I got with you all that if I would have succeeded in doing that, I'd have killed the wrong man. Because there was a thing and a change that was going to be allowed to happen to me that was absolutely phenomenal. And I was right there at the beginning of it. And that's why when I say I love you, I mean that. Because a lot of us don't get to open them doors. There's six of them there. A lot of people come through them and sit down in here tonight, but a lot of them don't get to come through there. And I seen a little card that was in the mail, and I'm sitting there trying to clear my eyes, and it said I had jury duty. And I said, oh, man, and it said on there, failure to show up, you can get put in jail and a fine. And I'm like going, I got to go see John. You know, I got to get to that treatment center. I tried to kill myself, and I'm sitting here, and I'm trying to get, you know, make logic. I'm trying to put the square peg in that round hole and all that. And some of you will be familiar with that. And I get down to the courthouse and I hand the lady that card and I'm explaining to her. I said, ma'am, I can't be here. And see, I ain't been with you all yet. It's just still coming. And I'm wringing my hands and holding them so she can't see me shake. And she's going, sir, it's your civic duty. And she went into this big recital that I imagine she learned for her job. And my patience is like, did nothing. And I'm standing there holding my hands looking at her. And she's filling it out again and getting the jury badge ready. And I said, I can't judge nobody like this. And she's going, it's your... And she starts in again. And I can't take it. I can't go through another poem. And I look at her and I go, boom! I set my hands down and got right down by her face. You know, bubble of privacy, people know. I got right down by her face. And she leans back with her little school marm glasses. And I go, I'm an alcoholic. First time I ever said it. First time outside of courthouse. Others in here, it's like, ooh, I said it before. But she gets up and she goes, just a minute. She goes through these doors like those. And when she come back, I realized some people really believe you can get this sitting by each other. She didn't come all the way out. She eased it open. She goes, you're excused. So I got on down and John seen me coming. And he did what happens every day. He broke his anonymity to me. He told me who he was. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was over 9 years sober. And I'm looking at him in disbelief. And, you know, there's like a spark of hope lighting up inside me. My sponsor, he said, Joe, you're going to be given a shallow opportunity with that new guy shaking. Just a few moments of where your heart's going to hit his. Or with the ladies, your heart's going to hit hers. And it's going to make that connection. It's real brief. Before the judging starts. You see, I've got an alcoholic filter in this head. My sponsor, the one I have now, he says, Joe, you're hardwired a certain way. That's why this fits in here. I don't know anywhere else that you could puke and they want to give you phone numbers. Here. You fit here, Joe. And so I'm sitting there and John's explaining about this program and he talked about a trip he made down to Florida on a vacation. He goes, I'm sitting on that beach, Joe, and it was hot and they had this big pina colada thing. This guy come by with his little umbrella and all that. And I can see, he says, I don't see the umbrella really. I see the condensation coming down the side. And he says, I started tingling right here. And as he was talking, I know that tingle. And I'm looking at him, you know, and he said, but you know what I did? I had my phone numbers of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous in that area, and I started calling. I thought, okay. I ain't with you yet, yeah. I'm thinking, I didn't say it, but I'm thinking, big deal. You called somebody. But he finished me off. He says, one guy at the meeting had a charter plane service, took me all over. He said, it's on me, free of charge, brother, I love you. Flew me all over, let me take all the pictures I wanted. I go, what? He goes, yeah. He says, another guy was a charter boat captain, had his own boat, went out deep sea fishing. He goes, I love you, brother, it's on me. I go, what? He goes, yeah. I go, I'm just hanging out in the VFW. I thought, I'm going to join this bunch. So he says, well, I'll pick you up for the meeting. And I thought, and I said, John, I'll meet you. He goes, no, I can pick you up. I said, I understand and I appreciate it, but I'll meet you. You see, I wasn't quite ready to bring my new friend home because he said he was an alcoholic, like for real. And it's like, it's okay that I've parked my truck up in the bushes on a Saturday morning and I'm outside. Yes, folks, once again, something about opening a door. It's okay that I did that numerous times, but don't bring John to the house. He said he's an alcoholic. Is there some insanity thing going here? And I went to the meeting, and here, anybody that's new, reasonably new, hang with me because this is incredible. I do not suggest you do this. If you're doing it right now, it suggested you quit. And by the way, suggestion means an indirect order. My sponsor informed me of that. I come down and John's all excited. He's like, you made it. And I said, yeah. And I'm the new guy. That sucks. And I go downstairs and I don't want to be the new guy. So I've got to get a game plan on. And I'm sitting there and they're looking at me going, hey, we're glad you're here. And I said, glad you are too. And they said, yeah, buddy, just keep it simple. I said, is there any other way? They told me later on, they said, Joe, you're so scattered, you could have posed for a group portrait. And I'm sitting there, and this little lady, and Eleanor, God love her, I told Doug, I said, your mama reminds me of this lady so much. She's so neat and had such a vital part in my life in this program. She become like a mom to me. Because mine was gone. And I didn't realize I needed another one. But God did. And this old lady, I didn't like her at first. This is my first meeting. And back then, they didn't have these styrofoam, nice Starbucks with a little wrapper on the side to keep your fingers from getting burned. They didn't have all that. They had the ceramic mugs. And when you was new, you had to wash them. And I'm in there doing this job that was assigned to me. I didn't realize it was voluntarily mandatory. And they're going, how you doing in there, Joe? And I said, oh, it's awesome. And I'm standing there under my breath thinking, and I'm washing them mugs, looking at them, hi there. You know, I'm not a new guy. I love washing these mugs. First time I ever did it. And Janelle, I can use her name now. She's deceased to the other side. Janelle was pouring coffee, and I go, whoa, 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 and she brings that baby up right to the top. And you know, day one away from alcohol, I'm shaking pretty good, and I get in my hands, and I don't want to be the new guy. And I'm sitting there, and I get my hands over around that mug, and I'm going, and she hands me a napkin, I'm thank you, and I'm sitting there, and I'm making sure nobody sees me, and I get down and get a little bit of the top off of it, and working it, and you know, I'm... She goes, I need to see that, honey. And I'm smiling at her. And inside, I'm thinking, you're really sick. I can't believe you're doing this to a person. But the thing is I did it to myself. I did it to myself. Every single drink, everything I did not leave me outside. I brought me with me. And I had to watch me every single time through those eyes, through the empty promises that I wanted to believe was real. I had to watch me. I couldn't get away from me. And I sat at the meetings, and the more I tried to look like I wasn't the new guy, it was so obvious. And it was really a giveaway. Guy come in, and he said, this is my first time at AA, and I thought, oh, bet, new guy, not me no more. And he starts asking him questions. Why do you ask questions? You're obviously a new guy. I'm not asking questions. Not Joe. And he goes, they said get a sponsor. And these old heads, they were like vultures in on him. They ate him up. They did it with kindness, but it scared the... I'm going, I thought, I still don't know what one is, but I'm going to get one. So they told me that Paul was up in the hospital dying. And I'm looking at him going, I said, okay, I'm going to go see him. I didn't tell him I found my sponsor. I go up to the hospital, and they've got Paul all hooked up with the hoses and everything in the bag. It's going in and out, and the meters are blinking and going on. And I go, oh, I got to hurry. And I get over there, and I get down where he could see me, and I go, Paul, Joe, Fairview Heights. And he goes, he remembered me, and I go, I need a sponsor. And he's nodding yes, and I go, cool. I said, all right, thank you. And I give him a hug, and Paul didn't die. So now I've got me at 30 days thinking it's 30 years trying to act that way, and I got him at 30 days out from me, and it's monkeys trying to catch a greased football. It's crazy. Here's the next miracle. There's a gentleman named Ed. He's deceased. When he passed to the other side, he had 54 years sobriety. He was placed in my life. He looks to smile and he says, yeah, he said, we kind of got together and said, somebody better get a hold of him. And he said, we drew straws. And he says, obviously I got the straw that had you. And this was going to be an incredible journey. Ed come in my life, and Ed was a heart surgeon, not in profession, in this fellowship. He knew how to do open heart surgery. He knew how to come in and make that incision on me. He knew how to talk to me. He could tell by my reactions, okay, it's time to close him up. And he always closed me up with something good about myself. And we had a lot of those surgeries. Some of them hurt worse than others. The amazing thing is through this whole career with him, I fell in love. I fell in love with a guy that was going to be absolutely incredible in my life. And when it come time for him to go to the other side, I was sensing it. I got word that he was in the hospital, and I hurried myself up there, and I seen him in there, and it's just like somebody hit me with cold water. And I'm looking at him, and my eyes are watering, and he goes, you're okay. And I said, I don't want you to go nowhere. I was starting to put stuff together with him. He showed me how to do the steps. This is a guy that when I did my first four step, I was so sick and so insane, I put down stuff I could have told anybody. And I was such a phony, I cried at what I had even notes, little cliff notes. On, you know, now it's time to cry. And I'd look at him, and this is what I did. And he's sitting there just smiling. He knew. It's like... And he told me later on, he says, I knew if we were lucky, you'd be back. And when I come back the next time with a list, it was there. And he knew it was there because I was going and getting coffee and kept getting coffee without even taking a drink. He knew. It's like, yep, he's got it down on the paper. But I'm looking at my old buddy sitting there, and to kind of give you a picture of him, he looks like Santa Claus. And he's got this beard, and he's got these crystal blue eyes. I can still see him. And he'd look at those, and he had these little reading glasses. And I'd be sitting there just letting everything out. And all of a sudden, I'd let something out I didn't know I did. And he'd pull them glasses down. And I thought, oh, man. And he goes, Joseph. He goes, Joseph, we need to have a talk about that. Here it come. We're processing through stuff. We get up, and I love this. It talks in there when they read step 10, and it said, continue to take personal inventory. And for me, just a while back, a couple years ago, for me it was continue to take personal inventory, and when I was wrong, lie, and then promptly admit it. Here's what happened. I come home, come from a meeting. I'm fortified. Woo-hoo, got the program. I see this car out in front of the house, and I go, it's in my parking spot. You know, in St. Louis, you got to, that's my parking spot. My wife keeps telling me, she says, honey, it's a public street. People can park anywhere they want. I said, not my parking spot. You know, I'm going to make an issue of it. Did I call a sponsor and tell him about this parking spot? No, I can handle this. He's helped me get along far enough. I look at that and I go, 911. And I'm telling them. And they said, we'll handle it, sir. And here comes this black and white pulling up, and I'm outside. My wife goes, that car looks awful familiar, honey. I don't know. I said, easy. Easy. It's my parking spot. She goes, okay, and she left. The guy's writing a ticket, sticks it in the window, and he starts writing again. I go, yes. Yes, this is justice. And he writes three tickets. And I'm going, all right, they're going to get this out of here. I go around for about a couple hours. I come back, and my neighbor has had both knees replaced in surgery, and he's on crutches, and his wife's helping him, and he's coming across. And I said, hey, Raj, how you doing? Not worth it. He starts cussing. I go, what happened? He goes, I got three tickets on my car. And I go, if I hear who did it, I'm going to handle it for you. What caused that to happen? Fear. I am terrified. I'm like, and I go inside and my wife's sitting there. Didn't say nothing. And I go, oh, this is bad. This is real bad. And she goes, didn't say nothing. So I hightail my butt up to the ATM and I'm getting money out. $75, buddy, for those three tickets. And I go down to the house and I said, can I talk to you a minute? And his wife's there and his daughter. And he says, well, yeah. And I took a deep breath and I closed my eyes, said a serenity prayer, which that's what you told me to do. It opens doors in the subconscious. It's absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Said a serenity prayer, and I looked at him and I said, I need to tell you that I'm the one that called the police on that car. And his eyes watered up. He says, why? I said, I'm pretty arrogant and ignorant. I wanted to prove a point, and it was a point I should have never tried to prove. And I said, I apologize to you, and I'm asking your forgiveness. And I start to hand them the money, and they said, we can't take that. You're our friend. And I'm going, and I'm starting to cry. And his wife's crying, his daughter's crying. And it's like, why didn't I just tell the truth? Continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, lied, and promptly admit it. It would have been much easier the other way, but not for me. I got my rights. I was told in later on by a sponsor that when you realize you've got a privilege instead of rights, you'll get along quite well. So I'm running around to meetings, nuts. Ed's reeling me in. But I made one more huge mistake before he got me lined out. I needed to go to a big book study. And you can't go in a big book study with a new big book. So I conveniently left it in the back of the truck. Rain starting to come through. Boom, that baby popped open. I look around, start writing on it, real little neat sayings you told me. Easy does it just for today. And I'm writing, and I'm opening it up, and I'm taking a highlighter, and I'm getting, oh, here's, man, this poem's awesome. Boom, boom. I'm saying, oh, look at this bookmark. Boom, and I'm loading that baby up. And I look at it, and I go, nah, and I take a cup of coffee and set it on there and kind of shake it a little bit, and that coffee rain gets on it. And I, nah, and I'm tearing on it a little bit. And I go in, I got this baby, and they look and they go, thumper. That's a thumper. No, that's Joe, stupid. After that little episode, I was allowed to apologize to approximately 200 people and show them that book, and I surrendered it to my sponsor, and he informed them he would not take a $10,000 bill for it. I didn't realize that they didn't make those any longer, but he says that means a lot to me because he believes, and I do too, that that was actually the start of me being able to absorb what you had. After that episode, that book was going to be everything to me. when Ed got up near the end, I got to see a man that could show me not only how to live in sobriety, he showed me how to die in sobriety. My buddy of many years is sitting there in a bed, and I can see him going. And I'm looking at him, and I said, "You're not going nowhere." And he takes my hand, and he says, "Joe, where I'm going to go, I've never been." And I said, "I know that." And he says, "I'll be a newcomer." Isn't that incredible? He said, "Do you know how special you are to us when you're a newcomer and still now? How special they are when they come in and they're shaking and they're scared and they can't believe something's going to turn around for them and they're expecting that right there?" And he says, "They're a big deal." He says, "I get to be a big deal again. It's been a long time. I'm looking forward to that." Incredible man. Incredible man. I hope I could even come close to scratching and have the ability that he emulated every day. He would tell you who he was. He'd tell you if he lied. He'd make apologies. I mean, he lived this fellowship to the fullest. I handed out earlier some little marbles, and I asked each person, I don't know how far they'll get, but I said, give each person a couple of marbles. And I did that for a reason. A friend of mine back home, he's unable to get around to a lot of the meetings now. He's crippled up pretty bad, colostomy bag on him, and he loves you all. He loves you drunks. And back home, we call him the Marble Man. Doug's a neat guy, and he doesn't mind me selling his name. He encourages it. He'd give you marbles, and he says, if you think that the compulsion's hitting you and you're going to have to take that drink, he says, throw it away, throw one of them. And he says, if unfortunately by chance you do take that drink, get rid of the other one. You've now lost all your marbles. Come on, get back to us. So that's why I wanted them to go around in respect and tribute to my buddy that can't get around here a whole lot. I've been given this gift without even asking. I was at home when the call come through to come and join you all. I'm planning a crappie fishing trip. You know, I'm going, go to, and I even pronounced it wrong, and they corrected me. Marinara is what I, and they said, "I know." And I'm thinking, I said, okay, because I know that I need to say okay. I also know that there's somebody in this room that I needed to see. And you all, like I said, you all spent a lot of money to get me here, and I wanted to see that person. That is the whole part of this. A president once said, "Who can so softly bind up the wounds of another than those who have felt the same wounds himself?" I know he wasn't talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, but boy, it sure sounds close. Prior to Ed passing, I was gifted a poem. I love poems. Love them. And I was gifted a poem, and it was about old-timers. It's called The Bridge Builder. I don't know if any of you have ever heard it. But I was at a meeting, and I knew if I don't tell my buddy this poem, I'm not going to get another chance. And he's sitting there, and I was their speaker. And I said, "Ed, I need to recite something to you for all the help that you give me." I said, an old man traveling his lonely way came to evening dim and gray to a chasm deep, dark, and wide through which there flowed a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream held no fear for him. He turned when he got to the other side to build a bridge to span the tide. "Hey, old man," said a fellow pilgrim near, "you waste your time in building here. Your journey ends with the ending of this day. You never again will pass this way. Sure, that chasm which was not for me to that fair-haired lad may a pitfall be. Well, your journey ends at evening tide. Why build a bridge at evening tide?" The old man lifted his old gray head. "Good friend on the path I trudged," he said, "there follows after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. That chasm which was not for me to that fair-haired lad may a pitfall be. Good friend, I build this bridge for him." That's what John did when he broke his anonymity to me. That's what Ed did. Paul, in certain measures, did it. My first sponsor that lived. And like I said, there's stuff that gets given to you without you even knowing it. And I was asked to speak at the Missouri School for the Blind. And I went and I told Ed about it. And he says, well, when do you go? And I said, well, I'm not sure I'm going to go. And he says, excuse me? And I'm not real far along. And I'm looking at him. I said, Ed, they're blind. He says, they can't see. They can hear. He says, they're not there to see you, big guy. And I'm setting me back in my spot. And he says, oh, you need to go. And he says, you need to accept that right away. And I did. And when I went there, I found out they weren't the one with impairment. I was. Sure did. I watched them come through a door, and they showed each other how to get to their seat. And they, one guy was, I know he was 8 feet or better from the door, and he had his head and his nose up, and he smelled and heard his friend, believe it or not, and said, Mike, here's your seat. And I'm going, wow. This is incredible. I shared my story, 150 kids there. Shared my story. God wasn't done with me. Those kids stood up and applauded. And I'm sitting there after having those thoughts I did about them. I got put in my place really quick. When they sat back down, one little lady remained standing. She says, Joe, we use a poem here that we learn, and we want to give it to you. And I nodded, you know, and I didn't know she couldn't, you know, I'm sitting here nodding, and she says, that poem is this. She said, she started talking about a mill. And she says, that mill, the water will never pass again. And as she's saying that, I'm going, the water, and it hit me. And I'm looking at her, and I thought, wow. I was allowed to experience something, and I'll wrap up with this. I was allowed to experience something pretty phenomenal. That school where all that abuse happened, it had closed. And I'm out driving one day, and the thought come through, go to your old school. And I'm like, where'd this thought come from? And I'm sitting here going and thinking to myself, you know, kind of that little drive where you're with your best friend. And I'm sitting there driving along, and I said, it's closed. And I'm driving again. It's like, go to your school. And I went down there, and it was open. They had a banner that said open house. And I go, what? Oh, my goodness. And I went over, and I stood. And as I was getting ready to go up the steps, I locked up. And that little guy inside, I mean, you talk about a knot in my stomach. And I sat there and I closed my eyes and I said a serenity prayer. And it happened again. I realized that you had helped me grow up enough that he wasn't going in there by himself. And I went in, I introduced myself to the principal, started talking to him about what happened. And he looked at me and said, would you come back here and share with the kids? And I said, yes, sir. And he arranged for me to talk to the kindergarten and the first grade. I don't know if I could do it today, but back then I could get this figure down in their seat. And I was down at their level. And I'm talking with them, and there's one little kid. This was in East St. Louis. There's one little kid, and he's so severely cross-eyed, he's got to turn his head to see me. And he's watching, and I'm talking to him. And I get done, and they all come in, and they hug me. And I give them a poster, and I told them, I said, you guys decide where the big kids in the school get to see this. And they had a wall there that was enclosed. And in behind that wall, I informed the principal that there's a marble staircase up to the third floor of their school. It's enclosed now. He says, I did not know that. I come back with some literature and stuff for him. And I walked through the door and got stopped again. Right there in the school where all the abuse happened, those kids decided to hang that poster. Isn't that incredible? Go to your old school. just out driving. My son, maybe sometime you'll get a chance, hopefully you get around my place. And by the way, you're welcome to my home anytime. Anytime. My son was incarcerated for 10 years, a little over 10 years. He had a 12-year sentence, 17 when he went in. I pulled up there, and I sat there in the drive, and I was wiping my eyes, and I'm looking at this wire and everything, and I can't believe my child's in there. And I can't go in. It's my first time to visit. I can't do it. And I'm looking at him at the place, and my eyes are watering up more, and I can't hardly see. And I go, I'm just going to get straightened up here, and I got to leave. And he'll call, which, you know, I figured he would, and I'll tell him. I couldn't do it, son. I couldn't make that walk. And once again, you all are giant killers. I'm sitting there in my car, and I close my eyes, I'm holding the steering wheel, and I'm, God grant me the serenity, and I'm saying the serenity prayer. And as I got done, I've lost a son too, you'll be okay, was said to me. Isn't that incredible? And I finished wiping my eyes, and I said, yeah, you're right. And I went in, I was able to go in and see him for the next 10-something years. Christmas Day, any time I can get there, you know, I was able to see him. And thanks to you all, he's coming in on 12-year sobriety. Isn't that incredible? I knelt down before I come down here because what I'm getting ready to say is not comfortable to say. But I know we have old heads, what's called old heads in this program. Some places they consider me one. I like to say I'm a baby old head. This is something I'm not proud of, but I need to say it. Because if there's somebody in this room that possibly is contemplating what almost happened to me, I need to share it with you. And I asked my father when I knelt down, I said, please let me be able to say this. I don't want to. I want to appear like I'm not a newcomer in this arena, but I need to say it. And I know that. A couple of years ago, I had engaged in a form of behavior that almost destroyed my family. Almost destroyed me. But God had another motive. I was laying there in so much grief and pain about my behavior, I didn't even contemplate drinking. I'm contemplating going out again. I'd gotten so big for my pants and gotten away from some basics that I needed. I was going out. And I was laying in bed, and I'm figuring I can start my four-wheeler, let it run, go out there and sit down, and it'll be over with. Didn't think about calling a sponsor, none of it. I was just too devastated. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, God, please, God in heaven, I can't make this. I can't do it. I do not want to die. I've got children at home still. They need their dad. I need me. Please. Please. And I heard my little one start crying. He had a bad dream, and I went and got him. I picked him up, and I'm hugging him. And I've always walked with him and rubbed his back. And I'm hugging him this time, and he's rubbing my back as we're walking. And I laid him down in bed by me. My wife's upset with me. She wasn't even in the bed. It's like, I don't care what you do with yourself. She's disgusted. And he's laying there, and he goes right on back to sleep. And I'm looking at him. And I'm sitting here and the thoughts come back again. Strong. When they talk of a higher power, there's a lower power, folks. And it was strong. And I'm saying again, God, please. And I wasn't saying it out loud. My little one wakes up and looks at me and he says, Daddy, we have a four-wheeler, don't we? And I said, yeah, we do. We'll go riding sometime. And I started getting my life put back together and doing what I needed to do and making the amends I needed to make. And I'm full of just honored and full of grace that it was given to me another start. I didn't have to go. I'm very honored that I was allowed to be here today. There's many, many people that could have been asked to be up here, and I'm aware of that. You asked me. I hope I done well. I'm looking forward. I was excited. I met Lorna and others, and I'm excited about the weekend. They say the Friday night person's the one that kicks it off for you. I hope. While we've been here, there's people outside away from here, that's dying. And some of them won't. And they're going to be brought here by a power greater than ourselves. They're going to be placed in your care. They don't even know they're coming to you yet. But I've looked out over the crowd, and I see the faces, and I can't think of a more awesome bunch of people for them to be placed with than you all. And allow that to happen. Thank you for your love. Thank you for your care and allowing me to come down here. God bless you.